founder of the Community Asylum Seekers Project, the Vermont organization, and he will be telling us more about it, I'm sure.
Back in 1980, my first wife and I moved to Brattleboro, and we hadn't realized that there had just been a resettlement of refugees from Laos and in Brattleboro at that time. But we moved into an apartment and realized that the people who lived upstairs from us, well, we noticed two things. One, they didn't speak English, and they never went outside to play in the snow. And so we thought to ourselves, well, these people need some kind of welcome. And so we baked a batch of chocolate chip cookies and went up the stairs and knocked on their door. And when they opened the door, we had no spoken language in common, but we smiled and nodded and bowed, and they kind of did the same, and we left them the cookies. Years later, you know, long after we had become friends with these folks and they had learned some English, the mom in this family admitted to me that when we left that day, she flushed the cookies down the toilet. And she explained that after literally swimming across the Mekong River with a baby in one arm, while soldiers were firing at them, while spending years in a refugee camp in Thailand, where she was miraculously reunited with her husband, whom she thought she would never see again, after being flown halfway around the world to this strange, cold place, she had no idea whether she could trust us or whether we were trying to poison them. And I'm not sure exactly what lessons to draw from that, but it definitely speaks to the idea of welcoming the stranger, and that it's not always straightforward or easy to figure out how to do it gracefully. Many years later, like a few years ago now, so 35, close to 40 years later, I was at a point in my retirement where I was looking for a place to volunteer. And I knew I wanted to do something that had to do with international or intercultural relations. And I ended up going down to to McAllen, Texas, on the U.S.-Mexico border, and volunteering with a Catholic Charities project there that helped asylum seekers as they were being released from detention. And this was very short-term help, so people would be dropped off at the McAllen bus station to catch a bus somewhere else in the country to live with family or friends. And the services that they would be offered just in the few hours they were there would be a drink of water, a warm meal, a chance to take a warm shower and receive some clean, used clothing, but clean clothing, and make a phone call. If they were staying overnight, most people weren't, but if they were staying overnight, there were some cots to sleep on. And I ended up going down, I think, four different times, probably about 10 days each time, and learned a lot in that process. I learned the difference between refugees and asylum seekers, which there is a technical difference, and it doesn't really matter for today's sermon. I learned a lot about the kinds of persecution that people were fleeing from, the reasons people had left their homes, everything they knew, in many cases their families, their loved ones, and I learned about the things that they suffered in this arduous journey from their home countries to get to the United States. I learned a lot about what they experienced in detention once they were here in the United States, once they asked for asylum. And over the course of the time that I was there, I began to understand that the people we were seeing were all people that had come to the U.S. to seek asylum, having fled some persecution, and they were had all been imprisoned in detention per the policy of our country. And yet they had all been released, and one thing that they had in common was that they all had family or friends that would take them in and support them while they underwent the process of seeking asylum. And I just began to wonder, well, I can imagine that most people in the world probably have some relative in the U.S. or some, you know, a neighbor from their village or somebody, but what about the people that don't have someone to take them in? And so I began to ask that question. There was a pro bono legal team working there at that clinic, and, you know, asked that question. And what I finally figured out was, you know, yes, there were people that didn't have a place to go and didn't have someone to take them in. And what would happen with those people is they would be kept in detention instead of being released, and they would have to struggle to present an asylum claim on their own, you know, without help, in English, from the confines of the prison. And statistically, I learned that that's, you know, virtually impossible to succeed at. Those people would almost all certainly be deported eventually. And also, had talked to enough people, most cases from Central America, you know, and it was clear, one man explained to me, he said, yeah, you know, a few months before I came to the U.S., a neighbor of mine had come to the U.S., but he was deported a short time after getting here. And when he came back to our village, he was killed within a few days of getting back to our village. The same threat that he was fleeing from was there waiting for him when he was returned to his village. And so I realized that deportation is not just an inconvenience, it's often a death sentence for people. So putting all of that together, as much as I was getting out from a personal point of view, I was getting a lot, I think, from a spiritual point of view, from a point of view of satisfaction, finding something good to do. I really liked going down and volunteering there. But I began to wonder, what about the people that don't have a place to go? And so I ended up getting together with some folks in our town and creating this nonprofit organization, which we call Community Asylum Seekers Project, or CAS for short, and with the idea that just we would be able to invite a few people, hopefully, to come live in our community while they sought asylum. And it took us a while to get going, but we eventually did. And, you know, to date, I think we've hosted 14 different people, some adults, and mostly adults, but some children, people that are seeking asylum in the U.S. And most of those people have lived with a local family or an individual who's opened their homes, you know, someone who's had a spare room and just said, yeah, they can live with us. And so that has been great. It would have been lovely. I know there's, you know, thousands and thousands of people that need that, and we've only been able to help, you know, a dozen or so. But I'm also aware, you know, you probably all heard the story about the woman walking on the beach and picking up starfish and tossing them back into the ocean, and somebody comes along and says, you know, that's what you're doing, well, I'm saving these starfish. And the other person laughs and says, well, you know, look at, there's millions of starfish on the beach. And, you know, what difference can what you do, what difference can it possibly make? And she picks up another starfish and throws it in and says, well, it made a difference to that one. And I think that we've figured out that we need to do as much as we can, but also be satisfied that we can make a difference with individuals, and we don't have to save everybody in the world to feel that we're making a difference and making an effort in the right direction. The other thing that's, especially lately, that's been particularly satisfying is that, as well as doing the work locally, we've gradually, over the last couple of years, have gotten more and more inquiries from people a little farther afield, a little sort of farther from our local community. And we've ended up talking with and kind of consulting with groups of people interested in doing similar work over in Keene and Alston, New Hampshire, and up in Randolph and Montpelier and Burlington and up in the Upper Valley, and then also here in Rutland. And the idea that this work is spreading out is very satisfying. And, you know, we'd love to have your support of our organization. And in fact, I brought some brochures, which are on the table back there, and a sign-up sheet if you want more information about what we're doing. But what I really urge you to do is to get involved in this fledgling organization that's happening right here in Rutland, Friends of Asylum Seekers Team, or FAST. And I know there's a couple people, David was at the meeting at Grace UCC a few weeks ago, where there was a meeting there and organizing that. So if you don't know about that, see David. Kate Taylor is that her name, and she's also is involved, and there may well be others here in the congregation that I'm not aware of that are involved. But it would be a lovely effort that your congregation could take part in, you know, whether it's as individuals or together as being active in that. I want to tell you a little bit about one of our asylum-seeking guests. Actually, the first person who came as part of a family, a mom, and she had two children with her. And I'm going to call her Rosa. So Rosa came came to the border, and basically she had heard about asylum, but didn't really know a whole lot exactly what it meant. But she felt that she and her children were in danger. And she came to the U.S. border basically to inquire. She lived in Mexico, so it wasn't a long journey to the border for her. But she came to the border sort of to inquire about asylum. And as soon as she asked, she was locked into the system. You know, she wasn't then allowed to kind of leave. But she was basically interrogated. You know, there was a strip search, and for a time separated from her children and interviewed separately, and then with her children. At that point, I think her son was maybe 9 and her daughter 6, roughly, something like that. And they were, after that first maybe 12, 24 hours or whatever, just sort of right there at the border, they were put in what's referred to in Spanish as the hilera, the ice box. And it's a holding, and they're holding cells that are kept artificially cold, so like, you know, 50 degree temperature or something like that. And they were there for a few days. They were in a cell with a couple other families. One family was a mom with at least one infant who, and there was no, the infant had a disposable diaper, and the mom didn't have any replacement diaper for that, so she would wash it out as best she could, but keep eating it. But eventually, they gave up on the diaper thing, and there was shit and piss on the floor, the whole of the cement floor where everybody slept. And that was the situation in which they were housed for a few days. Eventually, they were moved to what we think of as more of a standard prison, you know, not kept severely cold, and actually having beds instead of just a concrete floor to sleep on. And they were there about a month at the other prison. And there was reasonably decent food there. The children actually had school lessons, and there were classes in English and so on. So it was definitely an improvement, but it was still prison. And as Rosa said to me, she said, I couldn't understand, you know, we came to ask for help, but we were treated like we were criminals, you know, and I just didn't get it. That's how she expressed it. So at this prison, they call them detention centers, but that's a euphemism. At this prison, there was a pro bono legal team of some kind. I'm not sure if this woman was an attorney or a paralegal, but let's assume she was an attorney. And she worked with each of the moms in this was a prison for women and children. So she worked with each of the moms to sort of help make the connections with their relatives or friends that could ultimately sponsor them. And so, and Rosa, too, had arrived with a phone number, a scrap of paper, a phone number of some distant relative, somebody she didn't actually know, but maybe an uncle or somebody that she'd heard about, and had a phone number of somebody living in the U.S. At some point after Rosa had been there close to a month, the attorney called a meeting of a number, I'm picturing maybe a dozen, 20 of these moms, had all come into a room and sit in a big circle. And as they came in, she gave them each a pamphlet that was written in English and Spanish, you know, like the Department of Homeland Security pamphlet that talks about your rights and responsibilities in seeking asylum, and kind of outlines that. And gave each person that pamphlet, and on the cover of the pamphlet was a picture of the Statue of Liberty. One by one, the attorney went around the room and talked with each mom and said, you know, yes, so-and-so, we've made contact with your husband or your cousin or your sister or whatever, and they've actually gotten a bus ticket for you and your children, and you're leaving tomorrow afternoon, you know, so get your things together and say goodbye to your friends and so on, and we'll be going, here's the information. One by one, she went around, and she talked to each of those moms and then gave them their instructions. They left the room until finally it was just the attorney and Rosa left in the room. And she said, Rosa, we tried and tried to contact this relative of yours, but the phone number's not good, doesn't work, you know, not been any answer. You know, is there anyone else that you know in the U.S.? You know, is there anybody else that could take you in? And Rosa said no, but she held up the pamphlet and pointed to the Statue of Liberty and said, maybe she can take us in. The happy ending of that story is that, the happy ending is that the attorney said, well, I don't know much about this, but I've got this other possibility. We just heard about a little organization, a new organization in the state of Vermont, which is just the other side of New York City. And this organization might be able to offer a home for you and your children. And so that attorney contacted us, and we made contact with Rosa on a 10-minute phone call with an interpretation, which you could hardly hear. We determined that we would invite her, and she agreed that she would like to come to Vermont with her children. And she ended up living with Laura and me in our home for about a year and a half. And in that time, several months after they had arrived, we did all get to go spend a few days in New York City and got to see the Statue of Liberty. So it did kind of happen there. I want to end by telling you another thing that happened with Rosa, which is that, well, first of all, I want to explain kind of the living situation. We were living on a farm then, and we all cooked and ate together in the farmhouse kitchen most of the time. Sometimes Rosa and her children would, they had, in their little living space, they had a microwave and a little dorm-sized fridge, and occasionally they choose to stay in their space, but mostly we ate our meals together. And but that was in our farmhouse, and across the road in the barn was, it had been an apartment for the hired man back in the 1940s, but we'd gotten some help to convert it into kind of a more modern living space, but actually with an insulation and a heat pump and a tiny little bathroom. But the space of their living space, there was no kitchen, the tiny little bathroom, a very small bedroom, and a very tiny living room. And the whole thing, all three rooms, maybe the size of the stage behind me here. In those days, the office for Cast was just off our living room. It was just in our home. Now we actually have a little office in town, but at that point it was just part of our home. And as part of my job as this was a volunteer position, but as part of what I was doing in terms of organizing things, a lot of it was networking with people just like that attorney, but people around the country. So when we had an opening, I would put the word out and be able to find asylum seekers that needed us. But it was common enough that we would get a phone call or an email from time to time saying, you know, here's an individual or a family that has no place to go. You know, do you have an opening? And the answer was always no, because if we had an opening, I would have put the word out, but people would still contact us. And those calls, emails or calls, you know, usually if there was an email, I would follow up with a phone call anyway. But those phone calls were really good in some way, because I got to feel like I was on a team with some person somewhere else in the U.S., usually very far away, who was working in a parallel way on the same issue. And so there was a satisfaction in that, and I felt good in that collaboration. But it was also heartbreaking, as you can imagine, to hear about someone else that needed a place, but there was no place for them. You know, there was no room in the inn. And so almost always at the end of a phone call like that, I would be crying, and I would kind of wander out to the kitchen to see if Laura was around and tell her the latest story of who we couldn't help. And just sort of get some attention for my heartbreak. And so one day, fairly soon after Rosa and her children had arrived to live with us, I got one of those phone calls. You know, spent 10 minutes or so on the phone with someone from Texas or California or wherever, you know, and, you know, no, we didn't have a place for this family that needed help. And after I hung up again, you know, the tears are on my cheeks, and I wandered out to the kitchen to see if Laurel was available. And I found not just Laurel, but Laurel and Rosa were sitting at the table, just talking. And so I switched to Spanish and told about the call that I had just gotten about a family from Nigeria, the mom and the children were actually no longer in detention. The dad was in, the dad had been imprisoned separately, and he was still imprisoned. The family was homeless at that point, staying in a shelter, but they needed to leave. It was the mom and four children, and she was pregnant with them, so another one on the way. So, but if there was a place for this family of seven, soon to be seven, the dad would be released from detention and they could be together and they would have a place. And I told this story, and Rosa didn't miss a beat. She said, well, you know, the children and I can stay in our bedroom and they can have our living room. And it was just clear to her that it made sense to share what we had. And so it begs the question, you know, how much resource do each of us need in order to be able to share it as we reach to welcome strangers? So I'm going to give it back.
Are there responses?